This podcast of Word of Mouth is sponsored by
Dartmouth Hitchcock,
creating a new model for healthcare,
where leading health systems collaborate to improve care for all of us.
A sustainable system
improving the health of our communities
for years to come.
Information at imagine.d-h.org.
And Doucet Survey,
serving your professional land surveying and mapping needs in New England,
now with offices in New Hampshire and Maine.
Information at doucetsurvey.com. That's doucetsurvey.com.
Word of Mouth.
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 Mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. That's a clip from the song The Good Life by 3 Days Grace, which, according to a recent study, is the dumbest song of the decade. The study goes on to conclude that pop music is getting more stupid, pointing to a decrease in lyrical complexity and the average number of syllables used. Since the study was released, a number of media outlets have gleefully reported the results as confirmation that contemporary pop is stupid. Others call the findings racist, sexist, and elitist. Joining us to sort it all out is Chris Wright, who wrote about the study and its fallout for the Ideas section of the Boston Globe. Chris, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Hello, thank you. Nice to be here.
So according to this study, what makes The Good Life such an especially stupid song?
Well, first of all, we have to look a little bit at what this study was trying to do and who conducted it. The study itself isn't as interesting in the end as the sort of some of the questions that it raises. It's a little bit sort of junky science, in all honesty. What it did was it fed lyrics of popular songs over the last decade into online analytical tools like Flesh Kincaid and gauged these lyrics based on things like you said, number of syllables used and the complexity of sentences, but it didn't take into account things like meaning or metaphor and you know, things that really do give a song its soul as well as its sort of intellectual sort of quality.
This Flesh Kincaid scale, this is what it does is assign a grade-based reading level. So and who did the study, by the way?
It's an online ticketing agency, and the guy who did it, he's a young guy. I spoke to him. He was what they were doing was drumming up publicity, really, for their site, and they got it. I mean, it was picked up by a 1,000 media outlets, and it did sort of spark a conversation about what lyrics are, what they're supposed to do. You know, the main finding was that we were looking at lyrics dropping a grade point or two from an average grade level of 3.25 in 2005 to 2.75 in 2014, half a grade level, not a massive drop.
So that's like third grade to second grade.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
So you looked at the intelligence of some older songs using the same methodology. So let's hear a track listeners will probably recognize, and then we'll talk with you about what kind of grade it got.
How many roads must a man walk down before you call him a man? How many seas must the white dove sail before she sleeps in the sand?
So that was Bob Dylan's Blowing in the Wind. You analyzed it using the Flesh Kincaid test. Now, what kind of grade did that get?
What I found was that was deemed suitable by these standards for kids who are around 11 years old.
Uh-huh. And you compared that to another song, Trey Song's LOL Smiley Face. How did that stack up?
That was deemed to be more intelligent. You had to be about 15 in order to understand what he was talking about in that song. I hope you have a clip from that. Yeah, so there you have a kind of a flaw in the methodology of this report. But like I say, it helps raise this question. You know, why are lyrics good? When are they good? What does intelligence mean? If you look at the Cole Porter, Strange Dear But True Dear, When I'm Close to You Dear, Stars Fill the Sky, that's on a par with Bar Bar Black Sheep in terms of its complexity. But they're wonderful lyrics. They're poetic. They're full of visual sort of richness. They fit the music perfectly. It's a wonderful lyric, but it wouldn't score very highly on Flesh Kincaid.
But we know lyrics, you know. I mean, I'm thinking of ooh ee ooh ah ah, ting tang, walla walla, bing bang.
Mm-hmm. I mean, right. I remember. Great lyrics.
But I mean, a lot of pop songs use nonsense words or repetitive gobbledygook to make a catchy hook. That's what it's all about. I'm thinking of Hanson's mbop or Kesha's right. blah blah blah. Let's hear a little bit of that. How can that blah blah? I mean, if these verbal tools are not used to make a song smarter, then why do songwriters use them?
Well, let's look. I mean, if you look at the history of music, and I'm no expert, but you think about African tribal music, you think about Gregorian chants, all of which relies a lot on the quality of the sounds, the hypnotic repetition of sounds. I mean, that's what music is. You're not sitting down and reading a Russian novel, are you? You're listening to music. Eminem's a really good example. He was one of the sort of highest scoring artists in the whole study and was the highest hip-hop artist. But the genius of Eminem is the way he fits his lyrics to the music. They're not really, in terms of content, they're not particularly sophisticated, but the way he adjusts syllables to the rhythm and the way he syncopates that and the way he messes with rhythm and sound and meaning makes him, in my mind, and also Seamus Heaney once agreed, he's a lyrical genius, I think. He's a poet.
Well, does intellect have a place in pop music? I mean, it seems to me that the more overwrought songs get intellectually, the less good they are.
Well, the song Da-Da-Da-Da by The Police came up, and that's a wonderful song, and it does have some sort of fairly complex thinking in it, but Sting started to lose me. He, as his career wore on, he got more and more cerebral to the point where I couldn't listen to him. So it can certainly go too far. If you cut the emotional out or weaken the emotional because you're trying to be too intellectual, then you end up with a bad song.
I want to go back to what you said about genres a little bit earlier, mentioned Eminem. The study also compared different genres of music against one another, found hip-hop stupider than country, Lady Gaga dumber than Adele, and Kanye dumber than Drake. Based on what?
Well, this is where things get a little bit dodgy, because country and western ranked as the most intelligent genre of music out there. And the reason for that, as the author of the study admitted, was that it tends to use words like Mississippi and cigarette. So, you know, it was deemed one of the more intelligent. And of course, when you listen to some of the lyrics involved, they're not, you know, massively intellectual or cerebral.
This study was not published in a respectable journal. I mean, it was some guy's blog post, and its methodology, dubious at best. But it really touched a nerve. Now, why do you think so many people were hot to jump in on this debate over the intelligence of pop music?
Well, number one is people are always willing to jump into a debate about how things aren't as good as they used to be, especially once you reach a certain age. But there's also this fear that our kids are sort of spinning off into their own sort of universe, which is filled with drugs and sex and God knows what else. Pop music becomes a scapegoat for the illicit thoughts and deeds of youth. So when we criticize pop music, we're also criticizing the habits of the people who listen to it, I think.
Chris, do you have a favorite dumb pop song?
I actually like that song by Culture Club, War is Stupid and People are Stupid. And I haven't been able to get rid of that song from my head since I wrote that line, because it's a really, really good pop song. It's one of those things that just gets into your brain and stays there, just, you know, sort of like a squatter. It moves in and it refuses to leave, and that must mean something. And then, of course, you have the Milkshake song.
My Milkshake is Better Than Yours.
Yeah, yeah. And I just challenge anyone to think about that song and not be stuck with it for a couple of days.
Well, Chris, thanks a lot for passing on Milkshake. Now it's stuck.
Good. I'm happy to help.
Chris Wright, he's a writer and editor, and you'll find a link to read his article for the Boston Globe. Are pop songs getting dumber? That's at wordofmouthradio.org. My milkshake brings all the boys to the yard, and they're like, it's better than yours, damn right. Hrishikesh Hirway is creator of Song Exploder. It's a fantastic podcast that looks at how music is made. In this episode, Meryl Garbus of Tune Yards talks about the song Water Fountain. It's from the album Nicky Knack.
You know, I want my music to be a product of the world that I am growing up in and growing older in. So if this song is going to exist as a Tune Yard song, it has to have some dirty nasty to it. No water in the water fountain. No sight on the sidewalk. If you say, oh, yeah, what you doing there? Nothing much to do when you're going nowhere. Woo-ha, woo-ha, gotcha. We're going to get the water from your house, your house. No water in the water. My name is Meryl Garbus, and I make music under the name Tune Yards. Nate Brenner is a co-writer on most of the songs now that Tune Yards creates. It was January of 2013, and I was like, okay, it's the new year, and I'm going to start to make a new album. And so I kind of forced myself into this routine where I'd go into my little studio, which was a shipping container that had been made into a little rehearsal studio. So I was there in this like super hot metal box, sitting at a computer and trying to make all these demos. So I'd been taking a lot of walks around Oakland, and I was walking around Lake Merritt, which is just down the street from where we live. And I would just walk around that lake a whole lot and passing water fountains, some of them working, some of them not working. And, you know, at that time, I was hearing stuff about conservatives not wanting to pay taxes. And I just kind of let my brain wander, like, you know, what if no one ever paid taxes? And what if no one ever decided that it was worth it to put money into our greater good? Seeing that through my imagination that, you know, no roads, no sidewalks, no water fountains. I don't know. There was something about the rhythm of my walking and the rhythm of that phrase that no water in the water fountain that just like came out of that. The lyric and the melody and the sing-songiness of it and the topic of it, I think all came bundled up into one. When Tune Yards began, I was really interested in rhythm being a huge part of that. I just am super obsessed with the interplay between rhythms and this creation of a greater rhythmic whole when you have these multiple rhythmic voices going on at the same time. So the 3-2. And the other 2-3. And that was me, you know, in the hot box, just layering claps over one over another and just saying, okay, that's a start to something. And then I kind of would just hear what was missing, like where can I fill in even more gaps between those two clapping parts? And what I came up with was this that, 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 ba, dip, ba, dip. So it's really those three rhythms laid over each other. I love when things are human and not machine-like, obviously, as anyone listening to this music would know. It is not perfect by any means, but there's a tipping point at which I go, nope, I was a little bit too off the beat there for use in a song that I really wanted to be a dance song. The story of this song is basically that I almost threw it away because I thought it was dumb. It just sounded like really simple. I mean, think about me spending hours trying to work out laying my claps over one another and then coming up with the words like no wood in the woodstock. No wood in the woodstock. What the hell does that mean? And I was like, this is so annoying and I'm annoying and everything sucks. And Nate had a hot box across from mine and he would walk over every afternoon. It would be like a sanity check. And I'd be like, this sucks. And he'd be like, no, no, it's cool. And he came in and he played the first bass line that comes in. And I thought rhythmically his bass line was awesome, but I thought, no, it sounds too right. Like if you play in that kind of major key, then it's gonna sound too right and it needs to sound a little bit more wrong. We kind of fought about it a little bit in our peaceful way. And then he came up with if he's playing in minor. And all of a sudden the color of the song completely changes. And that was really important to me, that the things that this song was talking about to me were really heavy. And so it didn't make sense to just keep the whole song in major. It was like, this is disturbing. That's kind of where he was like, well, how about this? And I was like, how about that? And then we're like, okay, both.
I saved up all my pennies and I gave them to this special guy. When he had enough of them, he bought himself a cherry pie. He gave me a dollar, a blood-soaked dollar. I cannot get the spot out, but it's okay. It still works in the store.
It's still this pretty simple major melody, but then you just make the bass line minor. And all of a sudden, it's like the stomach churning part of the song, where all of a sudden you know that something's gonna go down.
Then your fingers through my hair, fingers through my hair. Give me a dress, give me a press. I'll give a thing a caress. Would you listen to the words I said? Sound.
You know, now there are a lot of people involved in Tune Yards, the record label and our manager, and they were like, this is it, man. This is the catchy one. Can you please just make it less dissonant? And I was like, no, I really can't. I mean, Tune Yards started when I was listening to a ton of dancehall reggae. And there's something about the tradition of reggae that for so many reasons, there is this dissonance and this kind of dub sensibility where there are things that feel wrong or don't link up exactly, but there's so much implied in that disagreement between elements. There's some reggae albums where you feel like the singer came in and sang and couldn't hear the track. And then the track that they end up putting underneath the singer is like a totally different song with a different key.
Murder, she wrote. Murder, she wrote.
Action with him, a pretty face and bad character.
So I love that sense of wrong parts put together, but then when it comes back together as a whole, it has this whole different conversation of wrongness. You know, no water in the water fountain is, it's like a horrible concept, even more so now in California. But in 2013, too, we were talking about the drought, and it was terrifying to me to allow my imagination to go that far and think of life without water coming out of your taps. You know, even just talking about these things now, it's like this really uncomfortable tension in my stomach. And I think that's the feeling that I love to evoke in songs, where I'm not writing pretty songs for people to fall in love to necessarily. I'm writing songs that sound more like the truth of the world to me. And that has to mean that that's literally built into the song. That's literally built into the harmonies or the friction or that grating sense of the song. And that's kind of why, I don't know, I was listening to that drum machine stem, and at first it's got the cute little cowbell sound, and then throughout the song, as you get to the end of the song, it's like this crazy distorted mess of a drum machine. I found this awesome water bottle at a thrift store, and it's just like these things that kind of fit into the world of the song, like spare parts kind of sounds. Like a water bottle just evokes water somehow. Even if you're not saying, oh, it's a water bottle, there's just something about it that's like, yep, that fits in. So this is where the brilliant John Hill comes in, because he introduced the laser sound. Now, we were so nervous working with other producers, and I'm very possessive of the term producer because I feel like, you know, I am my own producer. But we took the song in at the request of some of our label people and played it for John Hill, who's worked on a lot of cool stuff. Rihanna and MIA. And so he had those lasers for us. And I played those lasers on a sample pad with a stick. So we all agreed that that was, again, another dance hall element that amps up the song when it's like, and now the lasers come in. You know what it is? Oh my gosh. That's just me and my voice and my tongue making some crazy roll in there. But then sampled and played on a keyboard. So that we did with John Hill as well. We sampled my voice and then I was able to play it on a MIDI triggering keyboard, and I could play chords with my own voice doing that crazy gurgly noise. I am so captivated by music. The ability to speak without words. The sound itself is telling the story. And it's kind of like a big puzzle that even I am trying to figure out. It's so fun. Recording is amazing.
And that was Meryl Garbus of the band Tune Yards on Song Exploder, which is produced by Rishikesh Hirway. You can catch Tune Yards live at this year's Green River Festival in Greenfield, Massachusetts on July 11th.
Gather up the rain a coming, there's a rain coming down. Meet me out at the edge of town, there's a rain coming down. Tell everybody that the water's rising, there's a rain coming down. You think it's tame, but it'll put you in the ground, there's a rain coming down.
There's some fire, brimstone, a few country waltzes, and some barn dancing ruckus on the way to the Prescott Park Arts Festival on July 4th, thanks to the band Steel Wheels. The Harrisonburg, Virginia-based band got its start at Eastern Mennonite University and has gone on to make its mark on the Americana music scene with handcrafted songs and harmonies as rich, earthy, and storied as the banks of the Shenandoah River. Steel Wheels is Brian Dickel, Eric Brubaker, Jay Lapp, and my guest, the lead singer, guitarist, and banjo player, Trent Wagler. Trent, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thank you so much.
I'm curious about your origins as a band. Three of you were at Eastern Mennonite University. Are you all Mennonites?
We all grew up in Mennonite communities, and that is what led us to Eastern Mennonite University. You know, I think that that name Mennonite for some people is a real buzzword. It feels like a lot of people get the picture in their mind of, you know, four Amish kids coming together to play music. And there is a difference between Amish and Mennonite that needs to be understood. We all had electricity growing up. We all drove cars to our college experience. The Mennonite culture is not unlike different forms of Judaism, in that you have, you know, maybe the Amish would be closely related or similar to the Hasidic Jewish side of Judaism, while there are very many other kinds of Mennonites as well as Jewish people, including people who would almost be like a secular Jew, someone who identifies as Mennonite, but maybe never even really goes to church. So there's almost a cultural element to it.
Don't they also sing in four-part harmonies? Is that part of the culture?
Yeah, so a large part of the Mennonite culture over time has been rejecting a lot of technology, including pianos, including instruments in their churches. And so for many generations, that was the only instruments you had were your voices. And so we all grew up, singing harmonies, singing parts. And that was something that came very naturally to us then when we started this band, to always bring harmony.
Well, how about the content, though? I saw you at a benefit concert. This was for brain cancer research in Vermont. I guess it was earlier this spring. And some of the songs just felt like, I don't know, is it a tent revival or something? Is God and the devil kind of just below the surface in a lot of your songs?
Yeah. I mean, I think those are metaphors that I'm interested in. And certainly growing up in a church context, those are metaphors that are always present in your home on Sunday, but all through, you know, the way you explain the world and the way you think about it. But if you take a deeper look into the lyrics, nobody's trying to pound anybody over the head with any sort of theological notions about a Christian reality. I think it's more using these metaphors as a leaping off point, sometimes actually critiquing the very origins and the religion itself in certain songs.
Right, there's definitely a contemporary sensibility in a lot of the lyrics. Here's a song, in fact, that's a little more, I guess, Be Here Now. It's a song called So Lonely, and this is from the most recent album, Leave Some Things Behind.
and the starlight is shining so bright in the sky. Darling, I swear it's such a beautiful sight. It don't take no money to sit here and sing. You don't pay to worry what tomorrow might bring.
And the moon. So Lonely, a song from Steel Wheels' most recent album, Leave Some Things Behind. I'm speaking with Trent Wagler. He is the lead singer and banjo player and guitarist for the band. There's something so melancholy about even the joyful songs in this tradition. What is going on there?
Well, I don't know. I think that there's, just like the blues are a great way to get our emotions stirred and walk out in a positive sense, I think mountain music and some of the traditional music of the Appalachian parts of our country, there is a sense of melancholy. There's a sense of the minor key and the dissonance that comes with that. I think that, you know, where do the origins come from that? You know, whether that's in some of the Irish traditions that came over, or some of it's from the African traditions that pulled up through African-American spirituals and some of the blues music. All of that has influenced the mountain music that then has influenced us. But for me, I've always liked a good sad song. I love it. I don't think that makes me a sad person at all. It actually helps to add so much color to any person, I think.
There's something about listening to many of the songs that I feel this sense of, I don't know, an awareness or looking at one's place in the great big universe. Mm-hmm. And a number of songs here about the idea of home and family and what gets left behind. Mm-hmm. Longings of maybe a band on the road. Is that what's happening here?
Some of it is. Some of it is an autobiographical sense of, you know, the transience of being a touring band and leaving home. But I also hope that the songs go beyond that a little bit. And one of the things that I think I was musing on in the midst of this album was about the sense of how disconnected we can all be. You can have your 9-to-5 job, come home and sit down at the table and look at your feed on Facebook for the next couple hours and realize you never connected with the people right next to you in any real meaningful way. And so Leave Some Things Behind can mean, you know, being introspective and saying, where am I missing out on connection? But it also is, you know, what am I going to be conscious about? What are the things that I need to take with me into this next year, into this next trip? And what are the things I want to leave behind?
Well, let's hear some of that deep connection. This is a song, Rescue Me, Virginia, from Steel Wheels' most recent album, Leave Some Things Behind.
Ooh, rescue me, Virginia, rescue me. Sing the songs from the ancient, wash me in the sea. Rescue me, Virginia, rescue me. Difference where you go. It makes a difference where you go.
But Trent, I read that in college you played in a punk and alternative rock band. I mean, I guess it didn't stick. How'd you find your way to traditional mountain music?
To me, it feels like it's a natural transition. I think the heart and soul of what I saw in some of the rock and punk music that I was into when I was 17 and 18 years old is about a sense of peeling away any pretense, a raw energy, authenticity, you know? I mean, that's what appealed to me. And so I think that's the heart and soul of what I really got out of that music. And I do, to some degree, attribute it to being in Virginia, spending some time in college. I studied some theater. I got booked for a whole summer working at an outdoor theater in Lexington, Virginia. And we were doing a couple musicals that were written with Virginia in mind. And so the music was very much old-timey, some old country, and a little bit of bluegrass kind of feel. It kind of clicked for me. That same summer, I got to see Doc Watson for the first time.
Wow.
And he was just brilliant. And I'd never seen anybody pick the guitar like that. And to see this man is, you know, from a small town in North Carolina, who has been blind for his whole life and you know, is just a master of his instrument, and whose music has gone all over the world. I guess something about all of that, to me, it was as punk rock as you could get. I mean, it was so simple. It was a wood box and these strings and sitting down. There were no, you know, there were no effects. There was nothing but just the same thing you could hear on the back porch, exactly what you're hearing on stage. And that really impacted me.
Well, Trent Wagler, thank you for being so thoughtful and joining us today.
It's been my pleasure. Thank you.
Trent Wagler is lead singer, guitarist, and banjo player for the band Steel Wheels. Also in the band, stand-up bass player Brian Dickel, fiddler Eric Brubaker, and mandolin player Jay Lapp. In the background, we're listening to Mountains Quake from the band, and there's details on the Prescott Park Arts Festival lineup, and you can see videos of the band and more on the Red Wing Roots Music Festival that they produce each year in July in Virginia. All of that at wordofmouthradio.org. This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. The 4th of July holiday is like opening night for historical reenactors. From Boston's Freedom Trail to Gettysburg, insurance agents, dentists, lawyers, and mechanics don period costumes and attitudes to give visitors a more personal experience of battles and events that shaped our nation's history. Independence Day also marks the annual Mountain Men Rendezvous in Pinedale, Wyoming. There, dozens of rugged-looking men wearing animal hides shake off the yoke of civilization, tether their horses to trees, and make camp, joining others over grilled buffalo meat. My guest David Burnett spent 2 years among members of the American Mountain Men Association taking photographs, documenting a group bent on preserving the art of survival, self-reliance, and a way of life long since passed. His photographs appeared in an article for National Geographic documenting the Mountain Men Revival. David Burnett, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Well, thank you very much. Pleasure to be here.
This July 4th gathering repeats one that began more than a century ago. What do we know about this evolution of this rendezvous?
Well, what's really interesting is that when you go back and explore a little bit the whole Mountain Man period, which was from the 1820 to the early 1830s, it was kind of driven, as many things were then, by commerce, and it was by the simple fact that beaver pelts made the best men's hats. They would, you know, the Mad Hatter that we all know, the mm-hmm. phrase, the Mad Hatter. Well, the hatters went mad because they used mercury and other crazy chemicals to try and treat the final beaver pelts. But that was made into felt, which is what became the hats of that period of time in the early 1800s. So you had this group of very individualistic men. They were usually operating in small groups. There would be a few people remaining in camp, and the trappers would go out and set traps, and then every day go out and clear the traps and bring the animals back in. And the kind of the lousy work was to be stuck in camp. At least this is what they told me. And I went on a couple of days beaver trapping expedition in Montana a couple of years ago, and you know, that's the least fun part of it. It's not very romantic. It's a lot of work. Everything they did was a lot of work.
So these fur trappers, these mountain men, just drove the American economy and drove the movement out west. They kind of went out of fashion when fur went out of fashion. And it was revived again, what, in 1968, I'm reading from your notes. What was behind this motivation to revive the ways of the mountain man?
Well, the group was started by a number of Vietnam vets who had done one or more tours in Vietnam, and when they got home were kind of unsatisfied with the way their lives were going, and they longed for that kind of independence that, as a grunt in the field in Vietnam, you kind of felt this very high degree of self-reliance, and I think that's probably what drove a lot of it.
Huh.
And it's attracted a lot of veterans over the years, although there are any number of people who have not done military service, but there are a lot of vets in the group, and they really enjoy being out there either with a small group or by themselves, having learned many of these skills, how to build a fire, how to build a shelter, how to cook and skin animals, how to make coffee when you don't really have anything but a few coffee beans and an old pot. All these things that were very elemental skills, and which, aside maybe from the Boy Scouts, are just not taught anywhere anymore. You just, you know, as the society has become more and more urban and electronic, a lot of these things have just kind of fallen the wayside. And I think much of it is that much of the desire on behalf of these guys is that they feel a great sense of independence and freedom, and that they can kind of do what they want, how they want. And it's kind of fun to hang out with them because it's very different than, you know, I live in New York. I travel quite a bit, and there aren't many places where you really run into people with that kind of attitude and their desire to really remain unbridled by modern technology.
The pictures are just extraordinary. I mean, it really does look like you're glimpsing an old way of life. They look very, very authentic. So describe to people who aren't looking at these photographs, you know, what does a mountain man look like? What does he wear? What does he smell like?
Well, pretty much it's head to toe in buckskin, which is tanned leather hides from either buffalo. Maybe there was some that are from cattle, but I think a lot of it was buffalo. There were a few guys that had taken buffalo skins and fashioned them into a big winter coat, and various and sundry hats. I mean, the hats are kind of, you know, a combination of the old gnarly pre-cowboy hat, kind of hat with a brim, to these little caps that look like a winter cap, where it's just something on your head with a little tie string that goes down on either side. In addition, they have their powder horn, always carrying their musket, because you just never knew, you know, and to that extent, they're very, it's quite authentic. I mean, they always have their musket, and they have shooting competitions, which I have to say this, now that I get to say it on radio, I had never had a chance to fire a musket, and at the first roundup I went to, there were probably 60 guys in Kansas, and there was a shooting competition, and near the end of the thing, and I was shooting pictures every direction, and one of the guys said, "Hey, have you tried this? Would you like to shoot a musket?" And I said, "Sure, let me try that." So I fired, and they had this little metal target out there about 75 or 80 feet, and there was this ping, and everybody's like, "Wow, that was pretty cool." And at that moment, I kind of was accepted into the group that I could fire. I did way better than any of the guys did. And they said, "How'd you do that, man?" I said, "Well, I've never fired a musket, but I have worked a football game with a 400-millimeter lens. And I know when you have to, like, be steady and aim carefully."
I'm speaking with the photographer David Burnett about his time documenting the members of the American Mountain Men Association for National Geographic. You describe several of them, the Montana dentist Scott Olson. You know, he adopts a different name, Doc Ivory. Some of them shave with 150-year-old straight-edge razors. I'm trying to imagine this guy, you know, this dentist, looking into a patient's mouth under fluorescent lights and, you know, sort of thinking of life as a mountain man. How deeply do they go into this transformation?
Well, one of the things that one of my disappointments in the story was I wanted to actually go to Doc Ivory's office and
see
make
him
a picture that was a patient-eye view of what it was like, because I suspect he still comes to work in his buckskins, but I don't know that for a fact, and But it wouldn't surprise me, and I know that there must be a great deal of paraphernalia around the office that's Mountain Man related. But I did a lot of things, but I wasn't able to get to his office, and that's one of the things I felt bad about. But
so how did they get there? I mean, did they just all leave their car somewhere and, you know, mule in or walk in?
Normally, well, there'll be an area where you leave the trucks and the cars, and they bring the horses in, and there'll be an area for the horses, and then you walk another quarter mile, half mile to the camping area, and then at the big rendezvous that I went to, it was spread out over probably three quarters of a mile. You know, they're not really right on top of each other. Everybody's got their own little area, and then they have kind of a central area, and there's a little shop where you can buy, you know, people bring things. One of the guys that I met along the way became intrigued with 19th century firearms and has started building these beautiful handmade muskets that are almost perfect copies of these rifles from the 1820s and 30s. And so you see all this stuff on display. The level of craftsmanship is extremely high because there is this real desire to be authentic. And in those days, if anybody bothered to make something, they usually made a really good version of it.
Do they leave their cell phones and smartphones and cameras behind for this rendezvous? I mean, is it absolutely...
There's a few phones and a few cameras that come sneaking out, but I think everybody really likes to stay in the period. And then there were activities all day. I mean, at the rendezvous, you had these little seminars. And they believe that the education is a real part of it. So you had people doing, you know, how to pack a pack horse. Like, I mean, I'm sure that that's probably not a class that either you or I took in school.
No.
And they're just real genuine people, you know. They're not real BSers, and they don't. They're there because they feel a real affinity with that period of time. And one of the things that most people don't understand is that even though there had been some recording that the Indian tribes that lived in Wyoming had found a passageway through the Continental Divide, it wasn't until this path was rediscovered and became known by the mountain men that it was possible to bring a cart from St. Louis to the Pacific Ocean. There was this very, I got very emotional just standing in this little plot of kind of mountainous desert, a location a few miles after the pass, to the west of the pass. It was the point at which you had to decide, were you going to take the Mormon Trail, which would sort of head south into Utah territory, the California Trail, which would head straight on west through what would eventually become Utah and Nevada, or the Oregon Trail, which would take you up to the northwest. And a lot of historians of the West actually believe that had these trails not been made popular by the mountain men, that Washington and maybe even Oregon would still be part of Canada. And you could have a long discussion about whether that's a good or bad thing. But
Ooka-tie-i-o, get along, little dogies. You know that Wyoming will be your new home.
David Burnett, his extraordinary photographs of the revival of the American Mountain Men were made for National Geographic. You'll find a link to look at them at wordofmouthradio.org. Thanks so much for your listening time today. There's much more to hear and to explore at wordofmouthradio.org. That's where you can find a subscription to the Word of Mouth podcast, and you'll never miss a note. You can also sign up for it by searching Word of Mouth NHPR in iTunes. And if you like the podcast, you can write a review or pass it on or tell a friend. After all, the best suggestions travel by word of mouth. I'm Virginia Prescott, and we'll be back with more Word of Mouth tomorrow, too, right here on NHPR.
And bob off their tails, round up the horses, load up the chuck wagon.